the Cindy Alley and the summer of the issue. Today's the day you're gonna grab my jumbo blues. Well, it's hot stuff, yeah, and it's everywhere I go. I was thinking about the Lisa Keys. Couldn't keep them crying when she was born in Hell's Kitchen. I was living down the line. I'm wondering where in the world Lisa Keys could be. I've been looking for her even clear through Tennessee. My soul is beginning to expand. Look into my heart and you will sort of understand. You brought me here, now you're trying to run me away. The writing on the wall, come read it, come see what it says. Sleep over there, that's where the music coming from. I don't need any guide, I already know the way. Remember this, I'm your servant, both night and day. The pistols are popping and the power is down. I'd like to try something, but I'm so far from town. The sun keeps shining and the north wind keeps giving up speed. About myself for a while, though I can see what others need. I've been sitting down studying the art of love. I think it'll fit me like a glove. I want some real good woman to do just what I say. Everybody got to wonder what's the matter with this cruel world today.
Yeah, man, that ought to wake you up on Tuesday morning. I like that beat. Yeah, I like that beat. Hey, it is August the 25th, 2015. And boy, it's time to get that. If you don't have those donations in for the show, you better get them in, because it's the 25th and comes the 1st of September. Things are going to happen around here. I don't know quite what. Hey, we're at P.O. Box 401, that's White Area and Resistance, and we're in Warsaw, Indiana, not in Warsaw, Indiana, we're out in the woods, yeah, out here hiding in the woods in the bunker, yeah, right next to Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station, and weapons of mass destruction. Big yard sale out here going on. We've been moving a lot of stuff, man. We're getting a lot of good stuff in there from the Middle East. Yeah. And we get our Chinese friends to bring them over here, that bring all that stuff over here on their junks. Yeah. Once in a while we use a submarine. Yeah. ISIS, whoa, they're going to town, man. They're chopping the heads off, just like Genghis Khan did back in the old days. Yeah, he sure did, and that's what helped him conquer most of Asia and part of Europe. Yeah, and fear and terror, so don't ever tell anybody that that doesn't work, because the U.S. government uses it all the time, and it works for them, or sometimes, I guess. And it's an overcast day here in the Midwest. I think we're going to get maybe a little rain. I don't think we're going to get too much, according to the television. But anyhow, well, let's get going here. Let's get back to our pessimist guide to history. As soon as I find my place here. Where in the hell did I put it? Well, I forgot to put a real marker in here, but I see I made a pen mark, so I think that's it. 453 B.C., it was a very good year. I sang that song Saturday night. The girls all liked that one. That's a Frank Sinatra song. Plague ravages Rome. Rome just about to enter a period of rapid expansion. The real estate developers were ready to go. Was suddenly struck by a devastating plague that wiped out much of the city's populace. Expansion policies have worked against many empires over the centuries. The Roman example was not the first, nor will it be the last. Well, I think actually it improves the genetics of a race or a people when once in a while they have a terrible thing like that happen. Cleans out a lot of inferior genes. Boy, we got a lot of them we need to clean out, I'll tell you that. Going to be 100 years to clean up this mess that they put us in. But we'll get her done. Yeah. 430 to 427 B.C. Thousands die in plague in Athens. So it was actually before the plague in Rome. The Greek city-state Athens had enjoyed a long period of prosperity when war with its arch rival Sparta broke out in 431. You see how that works? Plagues and disease always follows war. Isn't that a good message to the white race? Stay out of war, especially fratricidal war with other white people, because probably twice the amount of people killed in a war are going to die of a disease after the war. The Athenians, then ruled by the great leader Pericles, decided to avoid fighting Sparta's superior armies by withdrawing inside the city's great defensive walls, while using the strong Athenian navy to engage the coastal raids. But as refugees flooded into the city at the first appearance of the Spartans outside Athens in 430, the populace fell victim to an unexpected enemy within the city walls, and that was the plague. The sickness was probably eruptive typhoid fever brought by an infected traveler from North Africa. Can anything good come out of Africa? I don't think so. Crowded conditions and poor sanitation helped spread the infection. According to the historian Thucydides, himself a survivor of the plague, the sickness began with the violent heats in the head and redness and inflammation in the eyes and the internal parts, both the throat and the tongue, immediately assumed a bloody tinge and emitted an unnatural and fetid breath, unquote. Somehow I feel like I've read this before, but I'm not sure. The plague moved inexorably through the victim's body, working its way into the lungs and finally to the stomach. In the 7 to 9 days it took to kill, the plague tormented the victims. Deep despair accompanied the beginning of the illness, so that the sick lost all desire to recover. Then came the burning fever. The sick often could not bear to wear any clothing and threw themselves into fountains in the agony of their unquenchable thirst, yet it was the same whether they drank much or little water. As the plague reached the victims' lungs, they coughed violently and retched uncontrollably. Sores broke out on their bodies. The plague ravaged the city for 2 years, continuing long after the first Spartan army had withdrawn. Thucydides described the bodies lying one another in the death agony, and half-dead creatures rolling about in the streets and round all of the fountains in their longing for water. Not even birds of prey would go near the corpses. The few dogs that fed the corpses supposedly died almost immediately. Funeral pyres of the dead burned throughout the city. In the haste to dispose of infected corpse, some people dumped the bodies into their other family's fiery pyres and ran away. Most of those who became sick died, while the few survivors often lost the use of their fingers, their toes, or eyes, or suffered complete amnesia. Those who recovered were immune to a second infection, however, and became the only nurses for the thousands of sick. Amid all this tragedy, those who had not yet been infected became determined to spend their last days in wild revelry. In other words, like a hurricane party. My gal was telling me about something she heard about this place where they were just going to party through the hurricane, and they partied and partied, and then they all died down south someplace. They feared retribution from neither the gods nor the law. That's a good feeling. The gods had apparently deserted them anyway, and no one feared the law because no one expected to live till judgment should be passed upon him. As Thucydides wrote, finally, after 2 long years, the plague abated for a year, only to strike again in 427. By the time of that year, it had killed as many as a third of the 100,000 people living in Athens. Among the many dead was the great Athenian leader Pericles. Oh, I see. I read that to you before. I'm sorry. Here's a new mark. I forgot to put a new regular bookmark in. I just put a little pencil mark. 426 BC, earthquake shakes Greece. Shortly after, 25 girls in Apollonis, Greece, had raced to the top of the harbor tower in order to get a view of the holiday festivals below a massive earthquake. I read that too. And I read this about Socrates. What? Here's another mark clear over here. What the hell's going on here? Let me see. You got to do more than put a mark in there, Metzger. You're going to be stupid all your life. You know you can't cure stupid. Okay, here we go. 390 BC, Gauls burn Rome. Roman armies, you know who the Gauls were. Those were the those horrible heathens from up north. Some of my people. The Roman armies had been virtually undefeated for 360 years when the Gauls, led by Brennus, overcame them outside Rome. Quote, there was a great slaughter in the left wing of on the banks of the Tiber, unquote, wrote the historian Livy, and many overweighted by their armor were drowned. Most of the defeated Romans retreated to nearby Veii, while some soldiers and citizens barricaded themselves in the citadel of Rome. When the Gauls entered Rome, they found the city largely deserted except for the wealthy patricians who, dressed in their finery, sat in the stony silence in front of their mansions. Confused by the patricians' regal appearance, the Gauls made no move against them until one Marcus Papirius hit an inquisitive Gaul in the head with an ivory scepter. Not a good move, Marcus. The Gauls promptly slaughtered him and the other patricians and began to sack the city. attempts to take the citadel failed, though the Gauls destroyed the rest of the city. There you go. Now I got to make sure I mark this right for tomorrow. Well, let's go back to the Jew Comes to America book for a while. We'll pick up where I left off. He shot policeman Murphy in Philadelphia some years ago. This was a kike. And escaped to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he was captured. On his way back to the scene of the crime, he jumped out of the window of a train and got away. Haig, on August 25, 1879, at 8th and Ransom Streets, Philadelphia, murdered James Riley, alias John Davis, another thief. He was captured and sent to prison, and his sentence of 10 years expired on June 3, 1888. This was another part of the Jewish underworld. The list of Jews who had been sent to prison during the last 20 years for setting fire to buildings so as to fraudulently collect insurance money is a startling long one. The records of the New York Fire Marshal's office show that a large percentage of the persons arrested for arson are Jews, and that two-thirds of the fires yearly occurred in the city of New York are in buildings occupied by Jews. Many of the insurance companies arbitrarily and systematically refuse to issue policies to Jews. This is a statement which is readily susceptible of verification. The Jew firebug is a very hard bug to convict. Long before he applies his lurid torch, or sprinkles his premises with flammable oil, he has plenty of witnesses of his accursed, says here, race. You know, we'll let him get by with that. All primed and fixed to prove an alibi, to swear that the firebug was out of the city, or mayhaps prostrating himself before the tables of the law in the synagogues at the time the fire broke out in his place. It is a matter of much difficulty legally to prove a case of arson. Under the existing condition of the law and a large percentage of kike Jews incendiaries who are brought to trial manage to escape conviction. The laws should promptly be changed with a view to specifically meeting the case of the Jew incendiary, the criminal who does not hesitate to consign the sleeping inmates of a household, men, women, and little children, to a horrible death for the sake of fraudulently collecting a few hundred or a few thousand dollars of insurance money. What form of crime can be conceived more monstrous than that of the Jew incendiary, firebug? In spite of the difficulty, there is, under existing conditions of the law in most of the states of the Union, in satisfactorily establishing a case of arson, a large number of Jews have in recent years been convicted of this heinous crime and suitably punished. In the various state prisons throughout the country, there are numbers of Jews serving out life sentences or long terms of imprisonment for this offense. To enumerate anything like all the cases of this character for which Jew criminals have been responsible in, let us say the last 10 years, would make a tediously long list. Let it suffice to detail a comparatively few cases occurring within the period named in New York City, and let these instances serve as a sample of the whole. There again, I read that page before. I didn't mark it properly. Boy, I'm telling you, I'm losing it. A most fiendish case of arson was the attempt made one stormy night in November 1878 by three Jew firebugs to burn the tall double tenement house at number 11 Ludlow Street in order to fraudulently collect the insurance money. In the carrying out of this attempt, these Jew kike devils endangered no less than 112 human lives. The fire was very similar to others which had occurred shortly before on the east side of the city, some of which had been attended by fatal consequences, and the police had come to the conclusion that these fires were of incendiary origin. The persons suspected were three kike Jews named Isaac Perlstein, Charles Bernstein and Abraham Freeman. The footsteps of the trio were dogged night and day by a young fireman named Purley, who had been assigned to the detective work by the commissioners at the request of the fire marshal. Purley was immediately successful. He discovered that these men made their headquarters in an East Broadway saloon. They held long conferences together and also with strangers. The latter, as was proved later, were a clique of Jew fire speculators who pointed out to Pearlstein, Barnstein, and Freeman the premises on which they held large insurance and which they desired to have burned down. On the night of the Ludlow Street fire, these three men were tracked to the rooms of a Kike Jew Confederate named Joseph Levi in the big Ludlow Street tenement. The occupant was, of course, absent while the firebugs were at work in his place. They scattered oil over the floor and the furniture, and very soon after they had quitted the building, the flames broke out. It was lucky indeed for the inmates of the great human hive that two firemen were at the heels of these Jew fiends. The two fire ladies, laddies, burst into the rooms and held the flames in check until the steamers and the hook and ladder companies, which had been called by telegraph, arrived. After the fire had been extinguished, the four Confederates, Pearlstein, Bernstein, Freeman, and Levi, these Kike Jew firebugs, who were responsible for over a dozen incendiary fires in the densely populated 10th Ward, were arrested together with Joseph Levy. Pearlstein, Bernstein, and Freeman were indicted for setting fire to the Ludlow Street tenement, and Levy as an accessory before and after the fact. The four men were tried before Judge Cowling and Barrett and convicted. They were sentenced to state prison for life. A Jew named Cohen Davis, who swore to an alibi for the Freeman, was arrested on a charge of perjury. He was tried before Judge Gildersleeve, found guilty, and sentenced to 7 years imprisonment for lying for the Kike Jews. The cap manufactory of Julius Sarner at number 68 Green Street was mysteriously and suspiciously destroyed by fire on a windy December night. The Jew proprietor was down in the fire marshal's books as a suspect, and a searching investigation was instituted. As a result, Sarner was indicted for perjury and swearing falsely as to the quantity of stock he had on hand at the time of the fire. Sarner's trial, which lasted 15 days, terminated in a verdict of guilty. He was remanded to the Tombs prison to await a sentence. But before the judgment of the court was pronounced, this Kike Jewish firebug and perjurer had gone to a higher tribunal to receive the punishment of his crimes. Seeing a long term of imprisonment looming up before him, Sarner swallowed a dose of Paris Green and died in his cell. In the cellar under the barber's shop at number 2349 Third Avenue, a fire broke out on the night of July 1879. The place was occupied at the time by Rudolph Levy and Fritz Levy, who lived on the premises in the back of the shop. The flames spread so rapidly that a servant girl in the house nearly lost her life. She was found hanging from a windowsill when the firemen arrived, and they, with great difficulty, rescued her. The fire investigation developed had been started by at several places in the kitchen. The next day, the Levi brothers, who passed under the name of Andre, were arrested. They gave bail, and when the trial was called, it was found that they had fled the city. Rewards were offered for their capture, and the fugitives were ultimately arrested by the criminal authorities of Berlin. The State Department ascertained that these Jew firebug barbers were Prussian subjects and could not be extradited, but that they were amenable under German law for offenses committed beyond the Prussian territory. A certain copy of the evidence in the case, together with diagrams of the premises that had been fired, The oil cans and other evidences of arson were submitted before the German consul. The two Jews were tried in the city court of Berlin, and Fritz Levy was convicted and sent to prison for 2 years. His brother was ordered to be placed under police surveillance. After his sentence, Fritz confessed that he had committed the crime in order to obtain the insurance money. A month after the Levy fire, a Jewess named Emma Orlock scattered oil about the premises number 1142 Second Avenue. The fire was attended with fatal results, and as there were strong proofs of incendiarism, the woman was arrested. She was tried, convicted, and sentenced to imprisonment for life. A fire broke out in the cigar factory at number 10 Hester Street in a few weeks later. Suspicions pointed to Israel Rosenbaum and Lewis Harris as the firebugs who had set the fire to the premises, and they were arrested. The authorities were unable, however, to procure sufficient evidence to secure a conviction, and the prisoners were released. But Aaron Harris, a lying Kike Jew witness in the case, was indicted for perjury and was sentenced to 10 years imprisonment. An incendiary fire took place at 253 Stanton Street in September 1884. Bernard Goetz, how about that? Bernard Goetz, that's the same name as the guy that shot the niggers on the train in New York. A Jew who had occupied the premises was arrested as being an author of the fire. The crime was clearly proved, and he was sentenced to 10 years in state prison. Another Kike Jew, a tailor named Morris Goldstein, was sentenced sometime before to 4 years imprisonment by Judge Sutherland for setting fire to the building number 15 Varick Street. Yet another Kike Jew, one Morris Heyman, was found guilty of having set fire to the premises at number 11 Thompson Street and was sent to prison for 3 years by Recorder Hackett. Well, I'm going to skip ahead on this book because it goes through a big, thick chapter on all these different people that these Jews that had set fire to buildings and everything. But the last page in that chapter says, "The Jew is a born malefactor. The Jew betrays alike employer, confederate, and friend. The Jew is a falsifier and a cheat. The Jew is congenitally corrupt. Shun the Jew!" Exclamation mark. Well, now we're going to go into the chapter on the Jew in petroleum. The petroleum business in the United States at the time this book was written is in the hands of one man in whose veins there unquestionably flows Semitic blood, as was demonstrated in the original Mr. Jacobs book. The career of the man who controls the petroleum business in the United States reminds us strongly of that of the Baron Hirsch of the Rothschilds and many other well-known Jew capitalists. There's absolutely nothing in his life that a parent would care to place before his sons as a model for them to emulate in their future careers. The petroleum king, as he's often called in accounts that from time to time appear in the newspapers, is about 50 years old. He was born in a little town in central New York, where his father practiced medicine. In 1853, the family took up its residence in Cleveland, when the future king attended school for 2 or 3 years. The king was not a promising student. In fact, he was not a student at all, which from his conversation is manifest to this day. It is to be doubted if the millionaire oil king is able to write a common business letter. Still, the king teaches a Sunday class, and it is as amusing as it is deplorable to see the ignorant yet vain oil magnate expounding the scriptural verses to the young Baptist, even though he's really a Jew. As he stands while expounding the Sunday school lesson of the day with his body slightly bent forward, his hand uplifted to in Jewish fashion, he, with his cunning eyes, sensual lips, and dilated nostrils, and that mysterious insinuating air that characterizes his very movement, looks like one of those money grabbers of the Middle Ages described by the graphic pen of Michelet. After leaving school, the king became a bookkeeper for a small commission house, and two or three years afterward, he and another man went into the produce business on their own account. This partnership continued until 1865, when the king sold his interest and went into oil refining. At this time, the king was 26 years old, and the property he then possessed could not have been worth much more than $5,000, and it was probably not all paid for. You know who this guy reminds me of? The Rockefellers. John D. I think that's what they're talking about. From this humble beginning has grown the giant octopus, that abominable futility that rests upon swindles, bad faith, and coalition. The monopoly, with its hundreds of offshoots and its more than $70 million of capital, of which he is today the head, the king is tall, lanky, and has an ungainly strut in walking. He has a prominent nose, the head of a bully, a pair of eyes that are neither black nor blue, neither gray nor brown, but a shade partaking of the color of pepper and salt. Their cruel, deceitful eyes unerringly indicating the inner nature of the king. When he distributes points as to the course of the petroleum market, he assumes a patronizing, insinuating air as he seeks to worm his way into the confidence of his listener. The king broaches the subject first lightly, in an offhanded manner. His position, he is wont to declare, is such that he could not speak of these matters out of the immediate circle of his associates. He talks in a low voice, pronouncing his words slowly, one by one, as if waiting for his listener to supply here and there a phrase to complete. His sentence. Next, he will raise his hands in the peculiar Kite Jew fashion, throw forward his head, and fasten his eyes upon you, whisper in your ear that he is about to inflict dire punishment upon the bears. His manner is impressive, his nostrils dilate, and his whole attitude is truly threatening. Before each meal, the king offers a prayer, and usually after breakfast, the family, which consists of three daughters and a son, pass into another room where the king kneels and again offers prayer. But lest the reader may be unduly impressed by this religious exposition, let it in confidence be said to him never to place any reliance in the promises of the king, never to follow his points, but always to do exactly the opposite of what he urges and advises. Copper him every time. Here we have a man who in a few years ago was comparatively speaking a poor man, and today counts his wealth by the millions, a man who boastfully claims that the profits of his business range from $10 to $18 million annually, a man who commands unusual favors from the railroads, a man who owns all of the oil cars that run over New York Central and the Erie Railroads, a man who practically does what he likes with our legislatures and our congressional committees. Has the reader ever thought that it is acts such as those performed by the king that hasten the ruin of an entire community? Men like the king are mainly responsible for the violent deeds of the anarchists, the communists, the revolutionists, and one has only to examine the history of the world to prove the correctness of this assertion. The people who have the good of their country at heart ought to band together and say to the king and to the men like him, halt. The power that you wield is dangerous to your common interest. You cannot thus shamefully disregard the laws of the country. Our lawmakers ought to find a way to suppress the acts of men like the king. Acts that produce, as an old Greek author forcefully put it, a nursery of villains. If matters are allowed to continue in the present state, at no distant day shall we have riots in this country such as are now occurring in nearly every country in Europe. Speaking of the millionaire king, it may not be out of place to give a brief account of the prominent Jew millionaires among us. The Seligmans from Bavaria, with no capital, and made their money first as itinerant vendors of notions, next as clothiers, and finally as bankers. Philip Heidelbach of Heidelbach, Ickelheimer & Company was also a native of Bavaria. He started life as a peddler. The Wormser brothers made their money in Sacramento, California, where they kept a clothing shop on what is locally known as the Cheap John basis for many years. Meyer and Emanuel Lehman, I wonder if that's where the Lehman Brothers banking family came from. Engaged in the cotton business, are natives of Würzburg, Germany. They make good beer in Würzburg. Their mercantile career started at Montgomery, Alabama, where they were dealers in notions. The Bernheimers were penniless on coming to America. They too commenced as peddlers, entered into the clothing business, and retired with millions. Adolf Schefftel, who is at the head of one of the largest leather establishments in New York, and who ranks among our millionaires, started business, as nearly all Jews do, with no capital at all, and trusting solely to destiny, in which all Jews believe. Solomon Loeb of the banking firm Kuhn Loeb & Company was a poor boy when he left his home in the old world. His son-in-law and junior member of the same firm, Jacob H. Schiff, you hear those names are still around, don't you? Came to New York City at the age of 18. He brought with him nothing and is now one of the richest bankers in America. The following table shows the leading Jew millionaires of New York and the estimated wealth of each. Max Weil, $9 million. Hallgarten Estate, $5 million. S.W. Glaser, $4 million. Solomon Loeb, $4 million. Henry Hart, $4 million. H. Bernheimer, $4 million. Isidore Wormser, $3 million. Simon Wormser, $3 million. A.S. Rosenbaum, $3 million. Max Nathan, $2 million. James Seligman, $2 million. Jesse Seligman, $2 million. Jacob Schiff, $2 million. A. Kerbs, $2 million. David J. King, $1 million. J. Schwarzschild, $1 million. Oh, wait a minute, here's something. David Metzger, $3 million. No, $1 million. And that's Metzger with an A, G-A-R, which I've seen that quite a number of Jews have that particular name. E. Ballin's estate, $1 million. Benjamin Russick, $1 million. M. Lazarus Estate, $2 million. Joseph Andrade, $1 million. Hyman Bloom, $1 million. Henry Liebman, $1 million. B. Altman, $1 million. J. Rothschild, $1 million. M. H. Levine, $1 million. H. Neustadter, $1 million. A. Reitlinger, $1 million. J. Reckendorfer, $1 million. Adolf Schefftel, $1 million, and E. Rosenwald, $1 million. There are only about 120,000 Jews in New York at this time, and their success in the business world is simply phenomenal. Of the 400 buildings in Broadway from Canal Street to Union Square, the occupants of almost all are Jews. Over 1,000 wholesale firms out of a total of 1,200 being of that group, Kike Jews. In fact, the business in many lines of trade is nearly monopolized by Jew firms. In Maiden Lane and John Street, the center of the wholesale and retail jobbing jewelry trade of the country, the name of the Jew is found right and left, above and below. Their dishonesty reigns supreme. West of Broadway, in Broome, Mercer, White, Leonard, Green, Grand, and other streets in New York, comprising the great dry goods and clothing districts, is a modern Jerusalem. 95% of the ladies' cloaks and suits sold throughout the country came from New York Jew houses. In the fur trade, 50% of the firms are Jew, and the capital invested is $15 million. The Jew controls exclusively the manufacture of hats, capes, and bonnets. He is also active in the tobacco, sugar, wholesale liquor traffic, holding large interests in each. Who is to blame for this material success of the Jew? The unsuspecting, generous Aryan. Do our readers know that in what is called the sweating business, a business controlled by the Jews, about 75,000 women are employed who work from early morning until late at night, but who do not earn more than $3 per week? This is the usual generosity of the Jew towards his employee. In the struggle for existence, a considerable number of these poorly paid women fill our streets, our penitentiaries, the gilded palaces of the metropolis, and the number of prostitutes today in New York is proportionally greater than that of any city in Europe, Paris itself not excepted. This may be news to most of our readers, but a consultation of statistics will establish the truth of this statement. It is the Jew alone, who is the cause of this degradation. The Jew, who controls the various trades requiring the patient work of a woman, by underpaying her while he boards enormous profits. He hoards enormous profits. Forces her down to the path of misery and despair. So, it's interesting, a lot of these women's rights people who come up over the years are Jews themselves too. So they drive the women down and destroy them, and then they say they want to help them and pick them back up. The Jew succeeds because the Aryan manufacturer pays higher wages than his Jew competitors. The Jew succeeds because his Aryan competitor has conscience, while the Jew has none. The Jew succeeds because in everything there is a manufactured by a Jew without exception, poorer material is employed than by the Gentile competitor. It results that the Jew undersells the Gentile and drives him out of business. I've seen that over and over with smaller businesses in L.A. area. If the Gentiles in this country would combine and refuse to deal with the Jews, if Gentiles would refuse to buy any goods manufactured by Jewish firms, if American women would absolutely refuse to patronize Jewish stores, these blood-sucking Shylocks would speedily be relegated to their natural sphere of action, the old clothes business, the old clothes, and underpaid womanhood would no longer be forced to the streets for subsistence. Remember, by encouraging the Jew in business, you indirectly promote vice, degrade womanhood, and dwarf the business prosperity of the country. And that's the end of that chapter. Let's finish out here with chapter 12, which is the Jew and his relation to the law. A Jew never hesitates to sacrifice his reputation if he can, by doing so, acquire money. The profession of the law has ever been conceded to afford scope for the highest and grandest efforts of human mind. The members of no other calling have equal opportunity for the temptation to see and to seem to profit by the weakness of humanity and its innate proneness to go astray. Society therefore owes it to itself to see well to it that those who administer the minister as priests at the sacred altar of justice are men above reproach, men fitting by birth, education, and training to understand, appreciate, and fulfill the highest duties and responsibilities of their position. It was the procession of these qualities which produced such jurists as Story, Kent, Cooley, and Eldon, and Mansfield, and Blackstone. In this noble profession as administered under your free form of government, and more specifically in the city of New York, what is the position and attitude of the Jew? Being free to enter its ranks, how does he comport himself when once installed there? The answer must sadden the heart of every true lawyer who has the welfare of his country and the honor of an ancient profession at heart. With the Jew, the practice of law is not a profession. It is not a science, nor does it even in his eyes attain the dignity of an art. It is to him simply a trade. It is only a means which he hopes to wring dollars from his unfortunate clients, whose interests are never permitted for a single moment to stand in the way of his own. In the course of the orderly administration of justice, he is not an assistant, but an obstruction. He does not suffer his mind to be enlightened and broadened by the contemplation and practical application of the great underlying principles of law and equity, principles which are founded upon eternal truth and justice. The atmosphere in which his legal mind lives, moves, and has its being is never cleared or sweetened and made wholesome and life-giving by the application of the golden rule. For him, the law laid down by the ancient lawgiver of his race, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is still an application as when it was delivered to his remote ancestors in the Mosaic Code upon the plains of Asia. We read in Holy Writ, "And the children of Israel did according to the word of Moses, and they borrowed of the Egyptians jewels of silver, jewels of gold, and raiment." And the vicarious chronicler who has been recorded this first bit of legal advice, given that of an ancient Jew lawyer, Moses, to his clients, adds quite unnecessarily this sententious statement, quote, "And they spoiled the Egyptians." We thus have significant and suggestive fact that the first Jew lawyer advised his clients in the gray dawn of history, urges them to commission of acts which in this day and generation would lead to their incarceration in state prison. The mantle of Moses was certainly fallen upon many Jew lawyer of the present day, and from that day to this the Jews have been engaged in the congenial work of despoiling the Egyptians and everybody else who has come within the reach of their long fingers. It has been said above that the Jew, the profession, and the law is a trade. It is even less than that. He is a scavenger and an ash of the ash cans and garbage bins of law. His narrow and contracting mind is continually devoted to little things. His intelligence is limited in its range and character, but his energies are all directed towards destructive and not constructive. The Jew lawyer leaves his uptown home and journeys towards his office. He purchases all the morning papers and eagerly scans them. Is he trying to keep abreast of current news, literature, or thought of the day? Not at all. He's simply reading each article carefully to see whether he can find out one that may be libelous. And if his eyes meet such an article, his rumor is once dispatched to induce the person mentioned to let his employer bring an action for damages on halves or on any other advantageous terms which can be secured. And thus, often actions are commenced not because anyone has suffered a wrong, but in order that a Jew lawyer may learn to extort a fee from one side or the other, plaintiff or defendant. It matters not which. There's not a newspaper office in the city of New York but will bear out the assertion that 9/10 of the actions of libel which are brought against newspapers are incited by irresponsible Jew lawyers who have taken the cases as speculation, and in the cases where recoveries are had, it is not the client but the lawyer who mostly profits thereby. Again, should his eye fall upon a newspaper record of some awful accident, a railroad or another collision, whereby a score of human beings have been tortured, mangled, or killed, does he stop to reflect upon the ineffable horror of such an occurrence, or the agony of the victims and their families? By no means. His imagination sees only fat verdicts or favorable settlements, which he may wring from some unfortunate corporation or individual in an action for damages. And before the breath has left the victim, he will be at his bedside, striving to make the most favorable contract he can obtain from his relatives for bringing an action for damages. These are not pictures of fancy. Every lawyer will at once recognize their accuracy, and scores of illustrations of their truth could be adduced from the register of every lawyer who has had a legal business of a newspaper or a corporation entrusted to his care. Again, two persons have a trifling difference, and in a heat of passion rush to their respective legal advisors. Are they advised to heal their differences and become reconciled? No, that would interfere with the scheme of a legal contest waged for costs alone. The peace of families or welfare of society are unmeaning terms to the Jew lawyer. He has no higher view of his functions than to make them contribute by every means which legal ingenuity can devise to his own pecuniary advantage. Will anyone have the courage to assert that this picture is too highly colored? If so, let him turn his attention to the following extract from an opinion uttered less than 2 years ago by one of the ablest judges now on the bench in New York City. Quote, "The action is for personal injuries, to wit, assault and battery, and has been called a trial. The parties are relatives, and the plaintiff states in open court that she has forgiven her trespassers, has renewed her friendships, and wants the further prosecution of action stop. The plaintiff's attorney insists that the old feud be reopened and the fight go on to the end, that he may get his taxable costs in case of recovery is had. The parties to a mere personal controversy should be allowed to settle their differences even without the concurrence of their attorneys. The language of the Holy Writ, blessed are the peacemakers, accords with the maxim, interest republica ut sit fini litium." That's Latin. "And every principle of law, order, and propriety agree with the peace of family now prevailing should not be broken up by the dark visage of intestine war, waged not for principle but for costs." Again, in support of the position above taken in regard to negligence actions, a striking illustration occurred in the recent case against a street railroad company, where a jury had rendered a verdict in favor of the plaintiff, which was set aside by the court, although the court stated that the power so to control verdicts had only been exercised in the court twice in 7 years, and added, quote, "To those two, it is my duty to add a third. I did so with a firm confidence that I am arresting, for the time at least, a most iniquitous proceeding," unquote. The court then proceeded to consider the facts of the case, in which it said seemed to have been fabricated by a lawyer. And after administering sound judicial spanking to the plaintiff's attorney, closed with quoting Judge Bronson's words in a similar case, quote, "We do not often disturb the verdict of a jury on the grounds that it is against the evidence. But if it should not be done in a case like this, there is reason to fear that trial by jury would soon cease to be a blessing and fall into discredit with other people. Need it be added that in each of the above cases, the plaintiff's attorney was a Jew, an old man who was rounded out long years of honor in the community, and who, by his sterling worth and eminent business capacity, has amassed a large fortune, reaches the end of his career and dies, full of years and honor. One of his children comes within the reach of a Jew lawyer, and straight away the history of the old man's life is subjected to a microscopic search for something which may tarnish his fair name and help to subvert his will. From New York to Michigan, a Jew lawyer prowls in search of fuel fed the whole unholy flame. He delves into the secrets of the sick room. He notes all the sickening details of his last agonies. He even reaches through the door of death and into the portals of the tomb and drags forth the secrets of mortal remains and flaunts them in the face of justice. And thus, week after week and month after month, the mass of putrid details is spread upon the record of a will contested until the justice herself almost sickens at the infernal exhibition. Yet this is a fair picture of the contest over the will of Jesse Hoyt, the details of which are still fresh in the public mind and in the public prints, and which began and urged on by a Jew lawyer. Well, let's see here. Well, that's about it for today. I'm going to close out with a little thing I've dug out here from the book Smoke about Charles Lindbergh. Charles Lindbergh, who had been speaking out against Lend-Lease to Britain, and I guess to Russia too, was trying to decide whether he should resign from the army. Roosevelt had obliquely charged him with treason. Quote, "Here I am, stumping the country with pacifists and considered resigning as a colonel of the Army Air Corps. When there is no philosophy I disagree with more than that of a pacifist, and nothing I would rather be doing than flying in the Air Corps," he wrote in his diary. Quote, "If only the United States could be on the right side of an intelligent war, unquote. That was on April 25th, 1941. So I guess we've been on the wrong side of these wars forever. Well, I'll see you tomorrow. Tomorrow is Wednesday, Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day, 14/5.
You're traveling through another dimension, a dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. There's a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, the Insurgent Radio Network.